Let's get this podcast started, shall we?
Let's do.
All right.
Shall we start it off with a dance number?
Dance number and talking raccoons.
My favorite
kind of raccoons. this is Part-Time Fanboy, and my name is Christian Horn, and I'm on the line with my good friend Paul Edwards, and we are here to chat about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Volume dos.
Dos in other countries. Volume two here. I don't know how to say it in any other languages, but yeah.
Ni.
Due.
Volume ni.
But
Volume due.
Which is probably, you know, I've been saying this a lot. It's probably one of the most anticipated sequels in years. Highly anticipated sequels in years. And I don't know. I don't know about you, but I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. What were some of your first? What are some of your first thoughts on
this
Marvel movie?
It was fun from beginning to end, and it really got me in ways that I didn't expect it to get me to.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to admit that I cried a little bit during it. So, it felt like more of the first, you know what I mean? It was like everything I dug about that first movie, but just more of it. You know?
Yeah. You know, go ahead.
That was sort of like all I could ask, you know, and it totally delivered for me.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting for me is that I felt like it was, you know, my biggest criticism of it is that it definitely felt like it was trying a little too hard in parts to sort of be that. Like, I was thinking about it today, like where the first Guardians of the Galaxy is sort of like Caddyshack. I kind of look at this one as sort of like National Lampoon's Vacation. You know what I mean? Like, I think Caddyshack, you know, at the time that all these movies came out and we were young and I don't know, I saw them on video. I think Caddyshack was like unexpected, irreverent, you know, like something that you weren't expecting. And Vacation was sort of like, yeah, you know, like this is kind of just as good, but it recaptures a bit of the silliness of that other movie that, you know, National Lampoon made, but it's trying a little too hard and it's showing, you know what I mean? And that is sort of my deepest criticism of Guardians of the Galaxy 2, where I feel like the first one kind of like was a complete surprise, and this one was, they were trying a little too hard to sort of like hit that like wacky button. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. I mean, you know, the first one entertained effortlessly.
Yeah.
And then what, you know, it's so to speak. And this one, even if it was a lot of effort. At least I still appreciated the fact that they were trying to entertain me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And yeah. What I appreciated the most is that how much fun I was having while I was watching it. You know, the thing that we always say about the Marvel movies, or that we've been saying for a little while now, is how much they embrace the insanity of
right.
whatever it is that they're, or the kookiness or craziness. And, you know, for this one, like, for me, I was like, oh my God, we are like all in on this. Like, this is like,
yeah,
like
for sure.
They totally embrace the cosmic nature of, you know, the Marvel universe, which I was just like so happy about.
Yeah. Yeah. Not only that, but you know, they really made it look great too.
Yeah.
You know? It was so really cool to see those giant sort of sweeping epic vistas that yeah. look like those beautiful Kirby drawings, you know? And wow. Yeah. It's really neat to see those worlds that we only like sort of imagined moving in our heads back yeah. then, to like actually sort of see them moving now. It's a trip. And the visual artistry of the Marvel movies, you know, I think is just really, really on point right now. Between this and Doctor Strange,
yeah.
you know, like this has been a great time for sort of epic visuals in the Marvel realm.
Yeah, like eye candy galore for yeah. sure. Like colors, like just bouncing off the screen. I mean, I was very, you know, very impressed with that. I mean, again, it's sort of the opening number is very much, you know, at this point, the Guardians they're obviously sort of like graduated to like bounty hunter status or whatever. And they're sort
right,
of like
right. heroes for hire.
Yeah, exactly. Heroes for hire. And, you know, and that first, there's a first opening scene where they have to fight this creature to defend these aliens' batteries. And that bit with like little dancing Groot while everybody's fighting in the background. Like, I yeah. just thought that was like, so inspired, but at the same time, I was very much like, oh my, like, this is kind of too much. Like, there's too much happening on the screen. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, one of know. The things I thought was interesting is that, in a way, it sort of breaks the expected Marvel movie formula about like the big battle scenes, you know? Whereas in, you know, Avengers and even the first Guardians and things like that, where you have this like sort of like giant epic, you know, battles going on, and but this one seemed less focused on like a lot of the fighting and more on those little character moments. Like, look, he's dancing his way through like this giant fight, you know,
yeah,
while
yeah.
everything's going around, you know. And even in like sort of the later climax, you know, parts of the movie, instead of like showing you sort of the epic scope of the battle, you know, sometimes it would just be like, you know, little things, little parts of it, and just sort of playing around with those. That's the thing I thought was kind of interesting, is that it's a movie that's, you know, you've got like the Marvel formula, but it's still like playing around with that formula and like, hey, you know, what if we did this instead, you know?
Well, for me, it's very much sort of like, you know, the Winter Soldier of like the Guardians of the Galaxy sort of thing, where Winter Soldier kind of delivered on a level that nobody sort of expected, you know, a Captain America movie to deliver on. And this one, you know, I think that a lot of people thought that the original Guardians was probably as crazy as you can get. You know what I mean? And I was, with this movie, they proved that wrong. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
There's one scene towards the beginning where, you know, they're flying through space and they're trying to get away from these aliens that Rocket Raccoon, who again stole the show for much of this movie for me. I just love the attitude and the sort of like almost like Gilbert Godfrey delivery of like, hey, stop it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like angry sort of like crotchety old man delivery of that Bradley Cooper gives it. But the scene where they're flying through space and they're trying to escape these aliens, and then you see this sort of like giant egg thing hurtling through space, and there's a dude riding on top of it. And I was like, oh, like, I was like, we're here. Like, we've done it. Like, we've really reached the sort of like, you know, that could have been Norrin Rad, you know what I
totally,
mean? Like, if they
totally,
had the rights,
yeah.
could have been the Silver Surfer for all, you know? And I was like, oh, we're going to do this. Like, we're doing this. We're embracing the silliness. And that to me is like sort of like them kicking it up a bit to 11. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. The fact that like you, I mean, and like opening with those, like in the incredible like visual of the, you know, the new alien races that they're introducing. What's the one that they spend most of the movie on? I forgot their name.
I can't even remember.
The gold people.
Yeah, the gold people.
The gold people, you know, I mean, like, it's just like a really cool, you know, like just, again, I'm just like sort of like was blown away at how like comic booky they not only like went with the look of the alien races and everything, but like you're gonna have to edit this out to make me coherent at some point. But like I was just really, really like pleased with like the eye candy of that movie.
Yeah I mean, I just think that there's so much there's just, I just kept thinking about, you know, you mentioned the gold people and she, the queen of the golden race is like pompous and sort of like kind of talks down to them. And I just love that bit with Rocket Raccoon where he's like, who knew that these people were such pompous douche, or, you know, whatever he says.
right,
like, oh, I'm winking with the wrong eye again. You know, that little bit where, you know, and it's just so much of like, I love how they sort of, you know, Marvel continues to sort of ground it in a bit of reality, but also be like, come on, we're not really taking this too seriously. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of hands where that whole scene in the chamber, with, the head of the gold race, the solid gold people, could be handled like really
the solid gold dancers
could be handled really over the top, with over the top seriousness and gritted teeth and like, how can you, but in a way it sort of again embraces this sort of Han Solo, you know, the Han Solo feel that these Guardian movies embrace, you know, where Harrison Ford, you know, was supposed to be this like hard edge bounty hunter, but he kept getting himself into stupid, you know, situations and stuff like that.
Right. And one of the things that I thought that was fun was even, you know, in the battle sequences when they're flying through space and everybody's talking at the same time and there's all this banter. I mean, it felt like word balloons, you know?
Yeah.
Like it just felt like those beautiful, like, I remember like reading the comic books and thinking, man, there is no way that they would have time to say all this stuff if like all of this stuff is really going on. But like these movies make that happen. And like that just blows me away that they do that.
Yeah. There's a lot of really, really great like stuff in here. And it really sort of like kicked in for me again, that moment where you see sort of a ego, Kurt Russell's ego sort of like zooming through space, holding on to this like giant space egg. And that's sort of very much where the movie kicked in. And I was like, oh, this is going to be like a comic book. You know, it may not be an exact literal interpretation, but we're going to be doing crazy stuff like this. And it just shows how, you know, how much balls like Marvel has, where they're just like, yeah, we're going to do this. And he's going to be a living planet. And he's going to talk about like, you know, all these things that he does. And he's going to walk you through the palace. And we're going to introduce you to Mantis, who is this, you know, woman who has antennas on her head. And she's an empath. You know, they keep dropping like one thing after another.
And hey, sidebar, like that whole thing with like the plastic people when Ego was talking, didn't that remind you of Heavenly Creatures?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, actually, that's a really good call. Yeah,
that was like a, I felt like that was like a callback to something like Heavenly Creatures. You know, yeah, I was just like, wow, that was really, you know, it was really neat. You know, like they tried something different with the exposition. Although, you know, even you know, a visual that like, you know, I've seen before in other movies of like, you know, the sort of the tableaus playing out while they're narrating, you know, but just the way this was done felt really organic and it you know, it made a lot of sense. It even led to some pretty like awful visuals later on.
Yeah, too. Yeah, that's true. You know, what's really funny is, I mean, the thing, well, first of all, my mind is blown away by the CGI de-aging process that's been going on in movies, because the movie opens up with Kurt Russell and Star-Lord's mom like racing along in a car like in 1970s, you know, going to the Dairy Queen, and Kurt Russell, who to me is like one of the handsomest men alive even now at his age, you know, you see the CGI sort of like D-make, and it's like MacReady or something just stepped out of like freaking The Thing, right?
Or
Snake Plissken. I mean, he looks like he did back
then.
Dude,
they went younger, man. They went like computer wore tennis shoes.
Not that young. No, that's a little too young. But I mean, I was definitely like, wow, this looks amazing. Like, I mean, you could tell that there was, you know... That may have been intentional too, the sort of soft focused 70s lens thing that was going on. And I was like, man, did they like give him a Breck girl haircut? Like they feathered it out. Like his hair was feathered out. Like, I mean, this guy, like he looked like he did like way back when.
And yeah, that was pretty unbelievable.
And I was blown away by that. But it's just so funny because it, obviously Kurt Russell, to like you and me and to people like us who grew up on his movies, is sort of like this iconic figure like in movies. And then to see him de-age like that, and it just brought back, it brings back like all these other things that he's done that you loved so much, and the smile that he had, that sort of like twinkle in his eye, they just captured it perfectly. And it was a really great sort of setup, because he's always that character that you trust in movies, right? He used to sort of be, you know, I would even say that, yeah, he looked like he stepped out of Big Trouble in Little China. You know, he was kind of the guy that you depended on in a lot of the movies.
Right.
And then it sets you up for what comes later, spoilers, which is, you know, sort of like that he was an alien and he's basically a celestial, which, you know, I don't know that Ego was in the comics. I should have consulted my Marvel handbook, you know, universe, but you know, and it sort of unravels the plot, because much of this movie is sort of like about parental and father relationships, you know, and basically a big chunk of this movie is Kurt Russell's character, Ego, an alien, sort of seeking out his son, and you sort of are clued into what Star-Lord's history is.
Right.
You know, and you're basically sort of like led through that thing. And what ends up happening is like, you've got this actor who is supposedly has this sort of like trusted demeanor throughout his career, ends up being sort of like a really, spoilers, big scumbag.
You know,
by the middle of the movie, or like three quarters of the way. Right.
Yeah. And one of the things that's like interesting too is that it sort of takes that whole, you know, Star-Lord is the man with the, you know, the man with the mysterious heritage, or, you know, the, like, he's the chosen one, you know, the only one that can do this. And it sort of turns that on its ear, you know, like instead of like that being like a great thing, it's not. You know, being the chosen one actually kind of sucks in this movie.
Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit like sort of the Matrix, in terms of like, you know, oh, well, what do you do when like you get, you know, you get to your goal and it's not what you think it is. And Chris Pratt really, I thought, did a really good job of like grounding Star-Lord in, you know, that wanting, you know, that adolescent, like wanting the dad and really doing, but at the same time understanding, you know what, I have responsibilities of my own. I've got to take care, you know, he really bridged that super well, you know? Again, it's really cool. Like that's such a big ensemble cast, like that everybody had like their own awesome moments inside of it. you know?
Yeah, they really built...
And even more, they introduced probably even more characters, you know, this time than they did last time around.
Yeah. Well, again, each, like you said, each character has a moment to shine, and each character has a really great, like, really great moments to not only play off each other, but to sort of, like, show you how they relate to one another and how much they care for one another. And it's really interesting to me how Drax sort of comes to the forefront in this movie as sort of like the I can't say the father figure, but sort of like the uncle that, like, holds the family together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sort of is like when everyone's getting upset with each other, he's trying to remind them what they're all here for. He's trying to give them all advice, which is, tends to usually be really bad advice because he doesn't sort of understand the vagaries.
He's the only one of them that's been a father. So
that's
like,
true
I think
too,
that
yeah.
he is, you know, in a way, it's like he wants to be the father figure, but he knows that they're not his kids. So, you know, it's like that's sort of the, like, touching thing about it, you know, is that this is his family, but it's, you know, not his real family. And honestly, that's the stuff that really ended up getting me in the movie. Yondu's whole sort of journey from this, like, crazy, pirate into, you know, a father figure that was like really well played. And like Michael Rooker really totally did an awesome job under all that blue makeup.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing with Yondu, well, I mean, the basics of the plot are that, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, they sort of like go on the run after the beginning of the movie because they betray this sort of alien. Well, mistakenly, I mean, Rocket doesn't. He steals a bunch of batteries from these, like, golden aliens that they were working
for. Because let's face it, he's a klepto.
Yeah, he is a klepto. he is a raccoon, and that's what they do. They come into your trash and they take your stuff. Which leads them to meeting this character called Ego, which ends up being sort of this godlike planet-like being that has created a sort of human representation of itself. And his big thing is what you discover is that he is Star-Lord's father and has been looking for him for years. He didn't know where he was because Yondu was hired to sort of kidnap Star-Lord, as we all know, and decided to keep him. And the excuse that he gave was that it was because Star-Lord was small and can fit into tight spaces so that he would be a better thief for the Reavers, right? That's what they're called?
Right.
Reavers?
Ravagers.
Ravagers. Sorry, Ravagers. Yeah, sorry. Reavers is sorry. The X-Men.
Joss Whedon. That's Joss Whedon, isn't it? That's the from Firefly?
The Reavers or the Ravagers?
the Reavers. Reavers are Firefly. Ravagers are Guardians.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, as the movie goes on, you start to see that the reason that Yondu actually kept Star-Lord, Chris Pratt's character, is a lot more complex than what, what is sort of a selfish reason, and it's more of a selfless reason, correct?
Right, for sure.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of, like, things in this movie that are played out like family dynamics, and they all sort of interconnect where you've got this, like, big cosmic setting, but like you said earlier, it sort of all comes down to the relationships between everyone and how they sort of are, you know, balancing off one another. I mean, I think they did a really good job of that through the whole movie. I mean, the one thing that was really interesting to me is particularly with Yondu's characters, like, especially in the beginning of the movie, and that's when they start introducing, like, these big cameos, like Stallone showed up. I don't even know how they kept that secret, because Stallone shows up and he's part of, like, a group that, you know, Yondu very much, you know, wants to have respect for. But what Stallone's character basically says to him is, like, you're trafficking in children or kids. And it's really funny because a lot of the movie one of the movie's big subplots is sort of like Yondu's sort of redemption. And by the end of the movie, they sort of play that out a bit. But there's a big part of me that could not let go of the fact that, like, yeah, basically Yondu was trafficking in kids, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And he delivering them to Ego, who destroyed them, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And so, yeah, he...
Which he did not know. Yondu did not know when he was doing it. He basically thought that he was retrieving Ego's children for him. But what you end up finding out is that none of these kids basically had the sort of special essence that Ego needs for his
that
plans.
Chris Prattness that really was required the whole time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That Chris Pratt had. Yeah. And so basically, as they were useless to him, he saw them as fodder because he is a godlike being who has been around for, thousands, of years.
Yeah. Oh, millennia. Yeah. I mean, since the beginning of time, pretty much.
Yeah,
and
I guess so.
So, you know, any living thing to him is sort of inconsequential.
Yeah. And I mean, the way that plays out is real genius because, I mean, it sort of does. I mean, you know, I have to say there is a predictability to it because, I mean, you know when Ego shows up and you know, like, he's his dad and there's definitely a sort of like, well, where's this going? And there's definitely a part of me that's very much, well, this isn't going anyplace good. But I think that James Gunn's direction is so well done that that when the turn happens, you know, it's not that it's out of left field, but it's like, oh, this is more messed up than I thought it was going to be, you know?
Right.
I mean,
speaking of James Gunn, hey, I like, his little character growing and developing there, you know?
The Yondu's like sort of sidekick or first.
Yeah, sort of his right hand person. Like, it was kind of cool to see that character grow a little bit, and you learn how dumb space pirates really can be in this movie.
definitely. I have to say the person that I was really impressed with too was Karen Gillan, Nebula. I was really happy that they sort of gave her more to do and the sort of way that her character and Gamora's character sort of balanced off of each other and sort of like came to this real big realization that they actually did care for each other. And it was more their sick and twisted father that made them sort of become enemies as opposed to them actually really hating each other.
Yeah. Yeah. It was neat. It was like two sisters who had spent their entire lives competing, but never like had the chance to sit and talk about what was going on.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I really enjoyed like all the sort of little character relationships and of course like the little like Marvel cameos that they threw in, like Howard the Duck appearing.
Oh
again,
my God.
Was amazing.
So happy. Yeah. And the Stan Lee cameo is probably, I told somebody at work today who hadn't seen it. I'm like, the Stan Lee cameo is probably the best Stan Lee cameo in all of the Marvel movies. I mean, come on, him sitting there like talking to all the Watchers.
For sure. That was a great, great moment.
Which surprised the heck out of me because I would imagine that the Watchers would be a Fantastic Four thing, right?
Yeah, maybe, who knows at this point? Like there's so many like crazy legal battles. I mean, I just, however they got them, they got them. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's so funny because you mentioned James Gunn's character. That's actually his brother, Sean Gunn.
Yeah,
that's what I thought when you first mentioned it. But yeah, Sean, I did like how that character sort of like came to the fore and had more lines and was definitely not the smartest guy next to Taserface, I think, which is kind of like, dude, has to be the lamest name for a villain.
Taserface.
He was genius.
Taserface was the best because, I mean, that was just like every like sort of awful, like generic bad guy from like space comics. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the way they just like sort of mercilessly like tormented him was fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely, It's funny because these sort of movies kind of remind me of the thing that reminds me of the most, and I've got to watch this movie again. I think it's like free on Amazon Prime, is Buckaroo Banzai, where like Buckaroo Banzai is such like a crazy out there thing that probably never would have gotten made like by any sane studio executive. But these movies, these Guardians of the Galaxy movies, remind me of that sort of thing where they just wholeheartedly embrace the nerdiness of like sci-fi and like space adventure and stuff like that, and still approach it a bit with you know, sort of tongue planted firmly in cheek, and with the, like the sense of humor of like, how crazy is all this, you know, firmly on display, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know of any other sort of major series that like dares to just sort of be weird like the way that this one does. And also at the same time adorable. And you know, sometimes in the same weird and adorable and crazy, like with the severed toe scene.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a baby, you have a cute, adorable baby tree creature just holding the severed toe. And it was like such a, like a jarring, like little moment, you know, I was like, that was really cool.
Yeah. 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 I just found out what the golden, people are called. They're called the Sovereign.
The Sovereign, that's right. The Sovereign who will be leading to Adam Warlock.
Oh my God, yeah, yeah, yeah. All the little buttons at the end too. Like Adam Warlock. Now, what do you know about that character? Because I don't know anything about him. Like, here's the thing is, like, I was telling my wife, like, after, like, I was not into like the Marvel cosmic stuff. Like, I was very much into like Avengers, X-Men, stuff like that. But for the most part, like, I never got into the Starlin stuff, or like, you know, I never read like Guardians of the Galaxy, or I never read like any of the, you know, space stuff all that much. Not too much of like Silver Surfer or anything like that, except for like the Jack Kirby original stuff. What do you know about Adam Warlock and all that stuff?
Well, I remember him from like Fantastic Four and stuff like that, because like that was where like he sort of first showed up, and like, no, like I think they called it like him, and then there was like the High Evolutionary, like, dude, I mean, it was like this crazy convoluted like backstory him. I remember about like there being like some sort of like fucking, like, if I'm a Counter Earth. Does Counter Earth ring a bell?
Not to me. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, there was like this whole strange being called the High Evolutionary, who would like sort of, he was sort of almost like Dr. Moreau in space. You know what I mean?
I'm looking him up, and I do remember this, that he was supposed to be some sort of like space messiah or something.
Right,
like that.
Right. It was like super, like, you know, very like space Jesus-y.
That stuff was like kind of weird. Like even Mantis making an appearance. And then I think there was a character called Moon Dragon who was supposed to be like the celestial Madonna or something like that.
Yeah. 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 It was definitely very much a product of the '70s, you know, that's what's kind of cool to see, is like this sort of '70s like vibe that's coming out of them right now, you know?
Yeah.
But he had like the Soul Gem, which I think was one of the Infinity Stones, and like he dies and resurrects a bunch of times, and Space Jesus is the sort of short answer.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting to me, and sort of like going back to, I found it very interesting that like, you know, they made a big deal out of Baby Groot, like in all the sort of like publicity and the trailers and stuff like that. But I found it really interesting that he really didn't take center stage all that much of the time. I mean, he was sort of there for like a little bit of comic relief here and there. But Groot was not like a huge part of this particular story. Would you agree?
No. It's like I agree. It's like you opened up with him in like, I mean, he was like the perfect introduction to the movie because everyone loved Baby Groot from the first movie. And here you get to see him dancing around and everything like that. And then it sort of gets into the movie. And Groot isn't as, yeah, as integral a bit as, you know, as like Drax or, you know, and that makes sense, you know, because at this point he's a baby, you know.
Yeah.
A baby is not going to drive your narrative forward the same way that, you know, the others. But it's kind of cool because it's like, again, they sort of took away like an element that could have sort of overshadowed everything else and put it away so that other little things could grow.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I thought they were very smart, like, with how they used Baby Groot, because, I mean, it was definitely a sort of thing of, like, comedic relief, but they never went too overboard with it. You know what I mean? Like, that Baby Groot is something that easily could have been sort of, like, very annoying, you
for
know,
sure.
if you'd have milked it too much.
He could have been Scrappy-Doo.
He totally could have been Scrappy-Doo. But, you know, it's definitely the sort of thing where I was like, oh, you guys were very smart because you didn't overdo it. There was a really good balance as far as, like, mm-hmm. all that played out. And what really kind of, like, always surprises me is how much, well, at least in this movie, you know what I thought? There's, like, a scene where... There was that scene where Rocket like kicks the crap out of somebody and it's mm-hmm. like really, it's like a bit intense and you're just sort of like, whoa, oh my God, he totally kicked the crack. And you know what I thought? I thought like when he hops off the guy or he's standing, I was like, Rocket is like Guardians of the Galaxy's Wolverine. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You look at Rocket and there's not one moment. I mean, you're obviously looking at a talking raccoon, but mm-hmm. there's not one moment where I look at him and I think of him as sort of like what you would think of when you look at like a Bugs Bunny or a Roger Rabbit. He's mm-hmm. not cutesy, and they do such a good job of like making him like a three-dimensional character, because I mean, I think that, you know,
yeah, that's the thing about Rocket and Groot is I don't think of them as effects. I think of them as characters, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I would say much more Rocket than Groot. I mean, Groot, especially in this one, again, because of the nature of what he is, you know, the sort of like little baby Groot and I am Groot and stuff like that. But I felt like, I always feel like they, but you know, in the first movie and this one, I really feel that they pull off Rocket in a way that just continues to sort of like astound me, because I again, it's this sort of thing that we've talked about before, and I think we even talked about it when we talked about the first movie, where you're looking at something that's completely CGI, and you're sort of just like relating to it, and mm-hmm. in a way, it's not like a real thing, but he comes across as very real and sort of like very, I mean, he is, you know, the crotchety, you know, old guy, but I mean, that's the way Wolverine always was in the comic books, and that's the way they seem to be playing Rocket.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like it's the whole thing of Wolverine being sort of the outsider, you know, who could never fit into society. And,
yeah.
you know, sort of that self-torture thing that goes on, you know, like, yeah, Rocket really has that, you know, and, you know, it doesn't seem like it like ever really goes away, even when he's with his friends. Like, that's just sort of a part of who he is. And, you know, that I think in a lot of ways, this was probably Rocket and Drax's movie, even more than it was like Star-Lord, who sort of comes to grip with his whole thing. Like, I felt like it centered even more on Drax and, you know, I'm sorry.
Rocket.
Lost my train. And Drax and Rocket than, you know, than, like, yeah.
Star-Lord. Like,
Star-Lord, dude.
Yeah. No,
I'm
you know
fried.
What?
Sorry.
No, it's totally fine. I what's really funny to me is, well, I think what they pulled off with Guardians, like the thing that you used to see, or at least when I used to sort of watch sitcoms, you remember that period in the 90s, maybe early 2000s, where they would trot a celebrity out and they would give them a sitcom and the celebrity was like terrible. And I'm not saying Chris Pratt is
terrible.
Yeah,
I know what you mean.
They were surrounded by, they made sure to surround them by great sort of like character actors or a great ensemble of actors, so that this lead, like in the middle of this crappy sitcom, you know, wouldn't fall on their face. You know what I'm saying? And
right.
They do a really good job. And, you know, James Gunn, who wrote it as well, he does a really good job of sort of like fleshing everyone out and giving them their own through line without pulling focus away from the main sort of story, which is sort of Star-Lord's revelation as to who he is, what he is, what his destiny is. You know what I mean? And, you know, they just bounce around a lot, but it's really deft storytelling because it's so much is happening, but not one side or one end seems to pull away from, you know, each other part of the story, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it moves so quickly, you know.
That's,
I mean,
true
it,
too.
It feels this movie, I mean, how many, what's the time period that this takes place over, you know, like a week? You know,
probably something like that.
You know, it really moves along quickly, and you know, you move, boom, you've got, you know, suddenly you've got like the Sovereign chasing you. Suddenly you've got, you know, I mean, it's like there are a lot of different threats to them,
yeah.
You know, throughout the movie, and they come from like all sorts of different angles. And it was just sort of an interesting joy to watch them sort of navigate this craziness.
Yeah, yeah.
And speaking of navigating craziness, man, the hyperspace jumps that they go through, that was one of the funniest thing. I just
oh,
laughed.
Yeah.
I laughed my ass off at that.
With the characters' faces being stretched out and them doing, yes, like, yeah.
Yes. completely ridiculous, but like completely hilarious. I loved it.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, yeah, I definitely, again, they just sort of like embrace the craziness and they just jump into it with both feet forward. There was something I wanted to address as far as like Chris Pratt and, Ego, that's what it was. Well, you know, again, I have to give props to Marvel again for, they do it every time where, you know, they introduce Kurt Russell and he's like, I'm Ego. I'm the living planet. You know, I'm a planet. Mm-hmm. I'm a celestial. And they show the origin and like, this is the brain floating in space. And, you know, all that stuff is like very cosmic and stuff. But there's a part of me that's like, oh man, we're not going to see. Because I remember like reading John Byrne, like Fantastic Four comics, you know, and particularly the entry in the Marvel Handbook of the Marvel Universe, that the Handbook of the Marvel Universe that we had in the 80s, it was a John Byrne drawing, and it's very much like a round planet, and it has a face, and you
right.
know, Kurt Russell's walking around, and he's talking about his origin. They're on a planet, and he explains that he was a planet, and there's a part of me where I'm like, oh man, you know, I'm disappointed. I want to see the giant planet face, and then at one point in the movie, they pull out, and they're pulling out from the planet, and it looks just like the face in the comics, and I'm like, come on, you did it. You did it, Marvel. You did it. You redeemed yourself to me. You know what I mean? Like, it's a face. It's a planet that's got a face. Come on. Like, that's great. Like, that's so great. Like, how could you not think that that's fantastic, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I really dug the way they pulled Ego off. Ego was a very charming villain, too. You
yeah.
know? I mean, that, you know, he did such a great job of like just, yeah, being like America's dad, you know, you know, and then like just turning into this horrible, like just psychotic, strange, like alien thing that, you know, just was like, really, I mean, like, man, Ego like turned into this like really horrible thing, you know? And it was just really neat to see that Kurt Russell performance, you know, still, yeah. you know, even there in the end, you know, like, you know, where it's pulling itself back to, and you're still like, oh, but it's Kurt Russell, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he's just so good. Like, he really is so charming and so likable. Like, I just, obviously you can tell, it's like, I love Kurt Russell and I've always loved everything that he's most of what he's done. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. even if what he's doing is not a great movie, like he has a charm about him and he's just so good in that. And what I love, again, what they do with this villain and what they do with him, towards the end of the movie where he's sort of like laying out like what he really wants from Chris Pratt, from Star-Lord. And mm-hmm. he basically kind of like, you're sort of like, okay, yeah, this is sort of like typical supervillain, but something's coming. And I kind of knew it was coming. And I'm like, okay, here it comes, here it comes. And then when he drops it, it's just such a, the delivery of his is so like perfectly like nonchalant. Like, yeah, I had to do this. Like, I don't, you know, that you're just sort of like shocked, you know, because I, you know that it's coming when he drops the bomb about what he did to his mother. And he just says it in such a way that it's like, and the audience in my theater actually gasped. They were like, oh, like you heard this sort of groan, you know, in the theater that I was watching it in. And it, it just, it definitely hits you. And it's just, he delivers it in such a way that it's like so matter of fact that it's like, yeah, hey man, you know, it sucks that I had to do that, but you know, and it's just such
but
a
you're
great
just not
delivery.
Seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah, exactly. You're just not getting it, man. You know, you're just not going with the flow. And he does such a good job of doing that. The America's Dad thing is like perfect, you know, because he really is sort of like, he does sort of play it as that, like, hey son, like, yeah, let's go. They do that little thing where he, you know, Star-Lord discovers his powers and they're sort of like throwing ball.
Yeah.
Ball
they're playing ball with the energy ball. Yeah.
And it's just so funny because so much of that stuff could really, again, this goes back to sort of like one of my major pet peeves in movies, you know, when the kid has not seen the dad, the kid thinks that the dad is dead and it's been 20 years or 15 years or whatever. And then the dad shows up and like, I think that they did a really good job in this movie of balancing that because, you know, most of the time I sort of want the sort of like big reaction, like, oh my God. And like the crying or whatever. But in this, there's just so much to take in, like living planet, celestial, like traveling the spaceways that, you know, it's so big in his head, but they play it off in such a way that it easily could have dissolved into like sort of schmaltz.
Right.
Or like cheesiness or ridiculousness. And they just balance that bar of like not falling off and just really sort of like being into, cause I, like admit it, that scene with the energy ball tossing back, that could have easily just been like, wah, wah, wah. Like this is
dumb. That could have been horrible, but it's Kurt Russell, man. Who doesn't want to play baseball with Kurt Russell?
Exactly. Oh, and if you ever get a chance, well, it used to be on Netflix. I don't know if it still is.
Battered Bastards of Baseball.
Yeah. Yeah. Great documentary about Kurt Russell.
Great documentary,
with
man.
Kurt Russell's dad. Yeah. Great documentary. Definitely. Yeah. The Battered Bastards of Baseball, right? That's it. I think that's it. Yeah. That's a great flick. But yeah, I mean, so they were really smart, like getting Kurt Russell to come in and play Ego because he just really, again, like I said before, he's really that likable guy that you want to like. And then when he makes that turn, it's all the more sort of like, oh, I knew it was coming, but damn it. You're just so swarmy. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. There's, you know, I mean, there's just so many like little great turns. What did you think sort of about like, I mean, it's really interesting because Yondu to me, again, I didn't feel like that character, I felt like that character was a little bit beyond redemption by that point. I felt like Michael Rooker's performance was fantastic. You know what I mean? I felt like they went as far as they could sort of with that. But I mean, for
I'll be honest with you. There's nothing better than someone who's beyond redemption, who's still trying for it anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. And I mean, I did feel like the sort of like,
Todd McFarlane built like his whole empire on that, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is I feel like, I feel like they tried really hard pushing that sort of like, I'm your real dad. I'm the one that raised you. I'm the, you know, and that didn't play for me as well as sort of like everything else did. I was like, yeah, but you threatened to eat him and, you know, you took him from his mom. You know what I mean? There was definitely a lot of things. And I don't think it has anything to do with Michael Rooker's performance. I just feel like it was sort of a very drastic change in
the character. Circumstances and yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, even in the first movie, he's not supposed to be the sympathetic character. And by the end of the movie, they're sort of making like Mary Poppins comments. And it's like, yeah, that's cute and it's funny, but this is not sort of like a warm, lovable character to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, that's part of like the fun of the Guardians is that they put these crazy, wacky moments into even like the heavies. You know what I mean? Like the fruit joke, you know, Nebula gets like one of the best jokes in the movie, you know, because they've set it up. So with the freaking fruit not being ripe, you know, like there's no reason why that character should ever make a joke, but she gets to make one.
Yeah.
And so like, that's Guardians of the Galaxy right there. And
well, it's also a great moment of character for her because she's not going to believe it. She's like that spoiled kid that you tell, like, look, don't do that. You're going to hurt yourself. Don't do that. You're going to hurt yourself. And they won't believe it until they actually do it themselves. And her, like, she had to experience it for herself.
Right.
And she had to prove to everyone that, you know, and she was proven wrong. So, you know, it's very much sort of that petulant sort of a child that she sort of, what was your take on
that
Mantis?
That point, by the way, was not mine. I was another friend of mine who saw that, my take on Mantis.
Yeah.
She was cool. I mean, you know, I thought she did like a really, she seemed sort of like what I remember Mantis being like from the comics, you know, in like sort of that, like you know, those sort of generic sort of ethereal 70s, you know, psychic characters that would pop up through, you know, those comics.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean that like sort of like that, but this one, you know, yeah, she was believable as somebody who was like sort of had spent her whole life as the product of, you know, like when he calls her, oh, you're a pet. It's like, oh, that's it. She makes sense. She's been a pet for her whole life, you know?
Yeah. It was really, again, sort of very interesting to me because it's a character that I don't know anything about. I mean, I literally know nothing about Mantis. And at first I thought she was sort of like that moon dragon celestial Madonna thing. But obviously it ended up being sort of a completely different character. But I really like what the actress did with her. I like it's really funny because it also plays to Kurt Russell's strengths in the fact that she's sort of like this baby, innocent, you know, naive character, the way that she kind of like plays everything out, especially the way that she interacts with Drax. It definitely probably leaves the audience sort of like, oh, you know, this ego guy has got to be good because he adopted this woman and he took her in, you know. But it also sort of plays into his sinister nature that he's basically just using her as kind of like a sleeping pill for like when he needs her, right?
Yeah. And, you know, that's the ego way there is, you know, that he pretty much only exists for things that take care of him. You know, he's like sort of the most aptly named character, you know, in Marvel history, you know. Exactly. You know, you think, oh, look, you know, this is an ally of his, but you know, if you think of it and look at it from his perspective, she's like less than nothing to him because she's, you know, everything is just so insignificant to this being.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, the way that sort of like relationship plays out, and I like how she sort of turns at the end. And I just love the comedic stuff with Drax, where he's like, "You're so ugly," and it's like obviously she's not, you know. And by the end of the movie, he's like, "It's okay. You're pretty on the inside, or you're beautiful on the inside." You know, it's just like all these like sort of like little turns between the sort of like two. I don't know what you would call them, innocent.
Well, they're both very socially awkward, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of fun is that, like, you know, there are two beings who sort of don't have the social skills or whatever that, you know, we sort of associate with being like whatever cool or heroes or whatever, but you know, they're just having fun together. And it was a lot of fun to watch that.
Yeah, and they're still very endearing as well. You know, What, you know, I mean, one of the last things I kind of want to say about this movie is it's really interesting how it still, at this point, doesn't really lead into any other Marvel properties right now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it seems to be coming. If you've seen the previews for Thor.
Yeah, Ragnarok.
You're definitely seeing sort of a crossover there between the superhero and the cosmic, you know, toward the, probably what I'm imagining toward the end of the movie. I mean, but yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting that like, that they didn't choose to sort of move their whole sort of Infinity Wars story along in this movie at all.
Thanos, no nothing, you know?
Yeah.
Which to me is like, how the hell is all this going to play out? You know, because there's just like a huge part of me, like we're sort of getting there, guys. You know what I mean? I mean, at some point we've got to start like merging these all together. I mean, unless, because I know that one of the things that they said in the first movie was that the Guardians weren't going to necessarily meet the Avengers. But if you've seen, you know, the sort of onset videos that that Marvel has been releasing, obviously Chris Pratt and, you know, Iron Man do meet up at some point or something happens, right? So when do these movies start, like, because you can't just have it just be, you know, these little bits at the end where they start melding or combining together, right? At some point there has to be some sort of like coherent.
I'm guessing that's the next Avengers movie.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But first you've got what, like Black Panther, right? And I mean, when is the next Avengers movie? Avengers Infinity War, right? Or something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
It's Infinity something.
I feel like it's in 2019.
2018.
But I could be... Oh, 2018. See? A year earlier. But yeah, it does make me wonder how they're going to move all these pieces into place to make sense before they jump in.
It actually makes me worry about Ragnarok because, especially from the trailer, now we're sort of seeing that Ragnarok is could very well be another one of these Thor movies that is being used to sort of bridge all the other Marvel movies together. And that's sort of one of the biggest problems I had with the first Thor movie.
Thor's. Yeah.
You know, is that it was used to like bring in S.H.I.E.L.D. and, you know, have all these, you know, sort of like the bridging between, you know, the Avengers and Captain America and all that stuff. So I'm wondering if I need to sort of be concerned about what's happening with Thor Ragnarok. Although I will say that trailer was badass beyond belief.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, like from the, like those 80s titlings and things like that. I mean, just like, yeah, I want to see that.
Yeah. I mean, there definitely is something to be said about like, hey, Guardians of the Galaxy did this. Now we're going to, you know, it seems like Thor Ragnarok might be Guardians of the Galaxy, like 2.5 or something like that, which, you know, I guess is sort of what's been happening with these movies. I mean, right. Avengers, what was it? What was the comment that was made? That's Captain America Civil War was like Avengers, you know, 1.5 or something like that, or some, you know,
right. 2.5. Civil War being like 2.5. Yeah.
2.5. Sorry, I forgot about Age of Ultron. But yeah, I mean, I guess we're going to see how it goes. I think Spider-Man comes out in July, right? I don't know how that will merge with any of the other bigger movies. And then, you know, sort of the big one, Thor Ragnarok in November.
Yeah.
So I guess we've got a lot of big Marvel goodness coming at us just this year.
For sure. Know? That's bananas. I can't.
It's totally bananas.
We've moved from like one of these, you know, a year to like several a year, which is, you know, that was their plan, you know, from the beginning. And they've really stuck to that plan. I'm super impressed with Marvel Studios and their focus on this stuff.
Yeah, their focus. Not only that, but their consistency of product. Because, you know, I mean, they've been making these things and they've been enjoyable, like one after the other. You come out of the theater and you really feel like, you know, I mean, if you didn't think it was the best movie, at least you had a good time, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Totally.
The last thing I do want to say about this movie is, and it is a critique of it, is that I cannot take my kid to this movie. I mean, even the first one was sort of like bordering. This is definitely a PG-13 movie. I mean, just way too many swear words, way too many sort of like dick jokes in there, way too much stuff about sleeping with and like female robot prostitutes, you know, a strip club. And that's the thing that sort of did make me a little sad, because my kid did want to see it, but I'm not going to be taking her to it. I think she's too young. I mean, obviously, you know, other parents have sort of their boundaries. And there was a bit where I was like, no, she could be. But as the movie sort of went on, I was like, yeah, I don't think so. And for me, this movie sort of very much came across like a movie very much for teenage boys, like an 80s teenage boys movie that, you know, kind of had like all the filthy humor or whatever, and so that boys could like giggle and be like, ha, 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 look at what they said, ha, 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 you know. And that was a little disappointing. I mean, I didn't feel like, not to sound like a stick in the mud, but I didn't feel like that needed to be in there. They could have maybe toned or played the humor a little differently so that it was more sort of audience appropriate. But you know, the first one was kind of like teetering on that line, and I let her watch it on home video. And there were definitely moments where I was like, I don't know. But I think for this one, if you're a parent and you haven't seen it yet, definitely see it yourself before you take your little kid to see it. I mean, I think PG-13 is appropriate. I think like 12 or 13 is probably the right age.
Right. Yeah, that felt sort of the target demographic there.
Yeah. I mean, but then, you know, I'm not showing my kid Scarface like some other parents, I guess. I don't know. Or Walking Dead.
Yeah, you know, say hello to your little friend. You know?
Yeah. Baby Groot. All right. Well, this has been Part-Time Fanboy. Any last thoughts, Paul? Or pretty much wraps it up for our Guardians of the Galaxy.
No, man, I had a ton of fun on that. The soundtrack is awesome, just like the first one.
Yes.
So I highly recommend that as well.
Yeah. Well, that was definitely one of the things, again, that I thought was a little overdone too, was the soundtrack. Because the first one, it made it sound like more spontaneous. This time it definitely felt like, oh, we got to have another song. We got to have another 70s song. We got to have another, like, that definitely felt like a bit more piling on too, but I still enjoyed it.
Well, dude, when you've got a Microsoft Zuni full of like
100
tunes,
songs,
you've got to use them all.
It's so great. Such a great joke. It is a really great joke. All right. Well, this has been Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Paul and I very much enjoyed it. Please check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that great stuff. And we will be back soon, hopefully with another episode. I am going to see this movie again this coming weekend. I liked it so much. All right. Have a great week. Bye.
Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Oh yeah, doing part-time. Oh yeah, doing